todo el mundo.
But this was really
1981.
Welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. I'm your host, Stacey Lane Wilson, author of the Rock and Roll Nightmares book series and director of the documentary The Ventures, Stars on Guitars. This is your destination for all things rock, where the interviewees include musicians, authors, historians, filmmakers, and more. And now, on to the show. Today's guest is Kirsten Foe, the writer and director of A Rock and Roll Cautionary Tale, Off the Record. While it starts off as a romance, this is no A Star is Born. The movie takes a very dark turn, and Kirsten is here to chat about that, as well as her amazing cast featuring Rebecca De Mornay and Billy Gibbons of ZZ Top. Let's get her on the phone now. Hello, Kirsten, and welcome to the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast.
Hello. Thank you for having me.
I really enjoyed your film. It's not common to have a drama film that's set in the music world, so it was my personal catnip. I loved it. I was looking you up a bit and saw that you're mainly a stunt woman. Did going from stunts into writing and directing, that's not the usual trajectory, especially for a drama. Usually it's an action flick, if that's the case. So what was it about this particular story that made you want to tell it?
Yeah, I do think a lot of people expected there to be an action movie. But for me, they say write what you know. And my experience coming to Los Angeles and being in the stunt industry, which is very male-dominated industry, I love stunts. It's been a really positive experience. Personally, myself and a lot of other people have had to jump through a lot of extra hoops, I think, as a woman. And I think this is present in every industry, not even just the entertainment industry, but especially in the entertainment industry. Stunts, it used to be that all of the, especially like stunt driving, was done by men with wigs. And so when I first got into stunts, like there was still a pushback of you're taking jobs away from us, from the men, which was wild because I was like, no, we just want an opportunity. And these are women, so they should be doubled by women. And finally, the union stepped in and was like, no, you have to double women with women. But it's just, it's always been this extra fight, right? To even have a place in the room and have people think that you belong there. And I think a lot of industries miss out on a lot of talent because of that, which is really unfortunate. And so when I was given, first off, I wrote the script kind of as just a therapeutic experience. I had gotten into writing and was really enjoying writing and wanted to take some of my frustrations about having to deal with this stuff instead of just being able to show up and do my best work, but having to like navigate all these other things as well. And I think once it was finished, I realized that if I wanted to make a movie, especially my first movie, I wanted to make sure that I was saying some of these things that I felt like needed to be said. And I chose to put it in the music industry because while film and television had Me Too and certainly didn't fix everything, but the conversation at least was there. I don't feel like the music industry really had that conversation in the same way. When I think women like Taylor Swift, it takes her becoming a billionaire and having so much power to be able to even tell her story and regain her power. And so what about all the women that don't have a lot of money and power and a team backing them, right? What happens to them? And so that was the story I wanted to tell, was a story that's familiar, I think, to most women, of just when we have a dream, the extra steps that we have to take. And I wanted to show a woman who pushed back on that and had some victories. Not all victories, but she had some.
To ask you about that a little later on, but now is a good time to dive in with, because you brought up the fact that the Me Too movement hasn't hit the music industry quite as hard as it has other aspects of the entertainment industry. And I'm wondering, why do you think that is? Is it just because it's, oh, rock stars will be rock stars kind of thing? That's already their reputation.
Yeah, there is a big thing, I think, where this idea of if you're a musical genius, then we not only forgive, but sometimes almost expect some at least eccentric behavior, if not bad behavior. And a lot of that has been, there's like mysticism around that, which is dangerous, honestly. We shouldn't celebrate having sex with underage girls or a lot of these things that we know about. And that's not to say that we can't appreciate art, but I do think sometimes we have to have conversations about what we excuse as far as artist behavior in the name of art. I don't think you have to be a terrible person to make good art, right? Like sometimes there's this excuse of that's their process, so that's just who they are. And it's, we hold other people to higher standards. Why wouldn't we do that with musicians as well? Because I've also been, my son's father's in the music industry. I've been on tour a few times with him, and I've seen that the female artists, even when they're very successful, they still have to navigate things in a very different way. It's like there is no amount of success that you reach where you don't. And so they have to be on very good behavior in a lot of ways, right? Like they can't just go out and break things and throw fits. And so it's like a very different standard there too, right? Of course. So just think there is a big overall problem of control by non-artists in both film and TV and in music, where the artists get such a small return on what they're creating that they're always which keeps them always having to create, right? Always hungry, which is what these executives want. And the people that are making the most money are not the artists. But that makes sure you can keep people in line a little bit, right? If people do have to keep touring and keep working constantly to support themselves and their families, they're probably not going to push back as hard on the system. Whereas, thank goodness she does, but somebody like Taylor Swift can, because they can't take that away from her at this point. What she has built, what she has rightfully built that is hers, can't be taken. But look how hard it was for her to build. Not everybody can do that.
Do have Gibbons in your film, which is awesome. I actually saw him performing at a Jim Irsay event in Beverly Hills a few years back. So since Jim exec produced your film, I imagine that's how it came about. Is that correct?
That's correct. I was at that event, actually.
Hello again.
Yeah. So, you know, Jim, I make the joke, he may not like that I'm saying this, but I think he actually may love music more than football. He's a huge music fan, as I'm sure you saw.
Oh, yeah.
And he also has 3 daughters and is very supportive of women being in power. His daughters are going to take over his team, right? He wants to make sure that they're treated fairly. And he extends that out to supporting all women, which is fantastic. And yeah, he was really great about opening up his Rolodex for us. I'm sure you noticed Peyton Manning, and we have Edgerrin James also in there. So, but Billy, he was really perfect to play our, he's the first one that gives the warning and he spots the scorpion in Brandon. And it was really perfect because he is one of the good guys for sure. He's just got the biggest heart, and he came on to set and gave us all these special little gifts. And he's a treasure. Obviously, like one of the most talented guitar players ever. So we were so lucky to have him.
Oh, absolutely. It really lends a fun bit of authenticity to your music world there. And so do your 2 leads. They really have good chemistry together, Rainey and Ryan. Now, did you audition several people? Like, I know they have chemistry auditions in films. Did you do something like that, or were they already in your mind to cast from the beginning?
Yeah, so we had Rainey cast first, and it was pretty difficult for us to find the right Brandon. We talked to a couple of guys who we really got the vibe that they were real kind of Brandons. Uh-huh. Having her be number one on the call sheet, Rainey got paid the most on the film. That was really important to us. We had a lot of female department heads too. We just didn't want someone that was going to come in and try to take the whole thing over. And at first we were looking at people who are play more of kind of the bad boy characters typically. And then we started to think outside the box and realized that finding a nice guy was really going to help us in a lot of ways, because A, it's going to be more of a joy to work with somebody like that. But also for the audience's sake, like people who know Ryan know him as a nice guy. They think he's sweet and they are going to be more trusting of him. They understand why she gets in the car with him at the beginning and why she doesn't push back when he takes her to the desert. Sure, I'd get in the car and go to the desert with Ryan too. He seems like a nice guy. And so when that shift comes, it's a little bit more surprising, because I do think that people who behave this way, they're very good at manipulating. And there's a whole psychology behind love bombing, obviously. And yeah, we needed to have that charisma and that big smile to pull everybody in. Chemistry developed on its own. We took them out to lunch a couple times in the beginning and made sure that they didn't hate each other. We hit it off. We could tell that they had the trust that they needed to have to play the roles. And
yeah, they really were believable. And I'm wondering, now you talk about Brian being a genuine nice guy, but I'm wondering, did you have anyone real, like any rock musician from music history in mind for the character of Brandon Burge when you were writing the script?
You mean, is he based on a real person? Yeah, there's definitely a couple of people, but there was one person in particular who I was a really big fan of. And then some stories and some information started to come out. And I think that really was the seed that grew, was because this is somebody who I'd seen in concert so many times. I'd actually gotten to meet them a couple of times, and like their music meant so much to me. And it was they'd always come across as a very like feminist person. And then to find out that they had multiple women came forward with a story of bad behavior, that was obviously true. And it was devastating. It was devastating to realize that somebody who I had invested a lot of time listening to their music and really loving them as an artist would behave that way. And I think that disappointment, honestly, really was the start of the character. Like, I still don't understand why people do this, why this false mentor stuff, why you would go to somebody and say, I believe in you, I want to help you, and then do the opposite. And it happens all the time, unfortunately. And it's a tough one for me to figure out, that character.
Yeah, it sounds like making the film was somewhat cathartic for you in that regard. Then you're able to tell that story from the feminine point of view. And Aster's diss track is absolutely great. Who wrote that?
Kyle Gass from Tenacious D.
Ah, of course. He's so talented and so funny.
Yeah. Yeah, we were really happy with that one. Our music supervisor is George Draculius, who I was just in awe of him. I still am. Like, he came to our movie from Barbie and Joker 2, and we're a small, very small movie compared to those movies. So to have his talent was amazing. Yeah, he brought in Kyle, and he brought in Lyle Workman, who did our score, and a lot of the music ideas came from George. It's really great.
The thing I did want to ask you about was that you said, despite the talent behind the camera and in front of the camera, it is still a small independent film. What was it like making your first feature during a pandemic and two labor strikes? You've really got to be tenacious, to quote Tenacious D, for that experience to bring it to fruition as you did.
Yeah. So our very first day of filming was Halloween, and that evening Rainey tested positive for COVID. And we were supposed to be getting on a plane to fly to Nashville because she was going to record a duet with Jason Isabel, which instead we ended up having Brandi Carlile do, which was great, but it was obviously very disappointing for Rainey. So yeah, we shut down a week right from the very beginning. Which, of course, you know, your first day, you go home and you're all excited, and then you get this phone call. So I was in tears Halloween evening. We definitely, it was a roller coaster. The strikes, I'm obviously in both unions, and so we were very good and adhered. I was out picketing instead of doing post. It pulled the whole process out, which gets a little scary, right? Because you start to worry like, oh my gosh, this is still going to come out, right? We're not going to get, because the longer it takes, the more money. And so... yeah, it was nerve-wracking, and it makes the fact that it is coming out now even sweeter, because it's a lot. And just the process of making a movie, I have to say, it's crazy. But I also really encourage people to try to make their own stuff. I think the more the studios are really like starting to look at algorithms, and it's just all about money. Art needs to survive in an organic way. It's not just about money. And I hope that people, because we have more technology now, we're able to use that for people to make smaller stuff and still make projects that are important, that say things beyond what the studios want to say.
Where can people find and watch Off the Record?
It is going to be on all the big streaming services. So Apple, Amazon, Comcast, all those guys, Fandango.
Wow, that's exciting. Congratulations. I really appreciate you taking the time to chat with me and share your stories behind the making of the film. I know this is the standard exit question, but what's next for you?
I am actually going to do something a little bit more action-oriented on the next one, but I am also staying in the realm of women fighting the power. So this takes place in the world of snowboarding, Olympic halfpipe snowboarding, women. And yeah, it's another fight the man story, but also an opportunity to show some amazing female athleticism.
Oh, fantastic. Thank you, Kirsten. I really appreciate you being here.
Thank you so much. Have a great day.
This concludes another episode of the Rock and Roll Nightmares podcast. Remember, there's a book series too. All the books are available in paperback, ebook, and audio via Amazon or the Rock and Roll Nightmares website. That's rockn-roll-nightmares.com. Our official theme song is She's Out for Blood by Fuzzbuster, founded by Lars Cabot. Thank you for listening.